This is KHOI, and I'm reporter Greta Anderson. As part of our Martin Luther King Day celebration, we are airing The Dimensions of a Complete Life, a sermon King delivered numerous times throughout his career, including back in 1954 when he was candidating for a position at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. That was his first position. So this was a sermon that he was very familiar with and then added examples from his own life as time went on. This particular version was delivered in 1962 in Yale University Chapel, and it is brought to us by Pacifica Radio Archives. With me today are two professors from the ISU Department of English, whose specialty is speech, Dr. Amy Slagle and Dr. Ben Crosby, and they will be providing their thoughts. Now let's listen to The Dimensions of a Complete Life.
Many, many centuries ago, a man by the name of John was in prison on a lonely, obscure island called Patmos. And in this situation, he had a vision of the New Jerusalem descending out of heaven from God. And one of the greatest glories of the new city of God that John saw was its completeness. It was not partial and one-sided, but it was complete in all three of its dimensions. So in describing the city in the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation, John says this: the length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. In other words, this new city of God, this city of ideal humanity, is not an unbalanced entity, but it is complete on all sides. Now, John is saying something quite significant here. For so many of us, the book of Revelation is a difficult book, puzzling to decode. We see it as something of an enigma wrapped in mystery. And certainly, if we look upon everything in the book of Revelation as a record of actual historical occurrences, it is a difficult book shrouded with impenetrable mysteries. But if we will look beneath the peculiar jargon of the author, that's something that biblical theologians refer to as the prevailing apocalyptic symbolism, we will find in that book many eternal truths which forever challenge us. And one such truth is that of this text. For what John is really saying is this: that life at its best and life as it should be is a life that is complete on all sides. And so there are three dimensions of any complete life to which we can fitly give the words of this text: length, breadth, and height. Now, the length of life, as we shall use it here, is not its duration, not its longevity, but it is the push of a life forward to achieve its personal ends and ambitions. It is the inward concern for one's own welfare. The breadth of life is the outward concern for the welfare of others. The height of life is the upward reach for God. These are the three dimensions of a complete life. Now let us begin with the length of life. And I said that this is a dimension in which the individual is concerned with developing his inner powers. In a sense, this is the selfish dimension of life. And that is such a thing as rational and healthy self-interest. If we are concerned about other selves, we must also be concerned about our own selves. Some years ago, a brilliant Jewish rabbi, the late Joshua Liebman, wrote a book entitled Peace of Mind. And he has a chapter in that book entitled Love Thyself Properly. And in this chapter, he says in substance that before we can love other selves adequately, we must love our own selves properly. Many people have been plunged into the abyss of emotional fatalism because they didn't love themselves properly. This dimension of length also means that we have a legitimate responsibility to set out to discover what we are made for, to set out to discover our life's work, the center of our talent. And then after we discover this, we have the responsibility to do that life's work with all of the strength and all of the power and all of the commitment that we can muster up. We should do it so well that nobody could do it better. And the individual must realize that no matter what this life's work happens to be, if it is for the upbuilding of humanity, it has cosmic significance. Everybody can't do the so-called big things. There must be those individuals who are willing to do a little job in a big way, to do the ordinary in the extraordinary way. And so to carry this point to one extreme, if it falls one's lot to be a street sweeper, he should seek to sweep streets like Raphael painted pictures, like Michelangelo carved marble, like Beethoven composed music, and like Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should seek to sweep streets so well that all the host of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, "Here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well." And this is what Douglas Mallock meant when he said, if you can't be a pine on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub on the side of the rill. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. For it isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. And when one discovers this and moves out to this end of self-fulfillment, he masters the length of life. But we must not stop here. Some people never get beyond this first dimension of life. They are often brilliant people. They develop their inner powers and to a great extent. But they live as if nobody else lives in the world. And that is nothing more tragic than to find an individual bogged down in the length of life and devoid of the breath. Now, the breath of life is, as I said earlier, the outward concern for the welfare of others. May I say to you this morning that an individual has not begun to live until he can rise above the narrow confines of his individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity. A few minutes ago, I read a passage from the New Testament, a very familiar passage. A man came to Jesus to raise some significant questions, and finally he got around to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" And this question could have very easily ended up in a philosophical or theological debate and in an abstract discussion. But you remember that Jesus immediately pulled that question out of midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho and talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. Three men passed by. Two passed on the other side, the priest and the Levite. And finally, a man of another race came by, and he stopped to help the man in need. And Jesus said in substance that this was the great man, this was the good man, because he had the capacity to project the I into the thou. Now, we have many theories about the reasons the priest and the Levite didn't stop when we use our imagination concerning this parable. At times we say they were probably busy, and they had an important ecclesiastical meeting in Jericho so that they couldn't stop. They were in a hurry. It is also possible that they were going down to Jericho to organize the Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal source rather than getting bogged down in an individual effect. But when I use my imagination about this parable, I begin to say that it is possible that these men didn't stop because they were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road. Some months ago, Mrs. King and I were in Jerusalem, and our guide drove us down the Jericho Road, and I never will forget when we started out, I said to my wife, "I can see why Jesus used this road as the setting for his parable. Here you find this meandering, winding road with many curves. Here is Jerusalem some 2,600 feet above sea level, Jericho about 1,000 feet below sea level, and this distance is traveled within 20 miles. And so the road was so dangerous that it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. And it was easy for one to be a robber or to engage in robbery on the Jericho Road." And so it's possible that the Levite and the priest raised certain questions within themselves. Maybe the robbers are still around. Or maybe the man on the ground is a faker and he is merely using this pretended robbery as an opportunity to get us over there for quick and easy seizure. So the first question that the Levite raised, the first question that the priest raised was this: if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and by the very nature of his concern, reversed the question: if I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? And so the Samaritan was great because he possessed the mental equipment for a dangerous altruism. He was great not only because he had ascended to the heights of economic security, but because he could go down to the depths of human need. He was willing to take a risk for that which was right. Now, I think this text has a great deal of bearing on the crisis which we confront in our nation in race relations. But in a real sense, the tensions which we witness in our nation can be explained by the fact that there are some individuals who are more concerned about length and breadth. There are some individuals who are more concerned about their so-called way of life, preserving a preferred economic position, preserving a particular political power structure. And if these persons would only add length to breath, breath to length, rather, if they would only add the other regarding dimension to the self-regarding dimension, the jangling discords of our nation would be transformed into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. Somewhere along the way, all men in this nation must come to see that all men are made to live together as brothers. This concern for breath is found deep in the American dream. For at the center of that dream, we find these words: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so when we read this dream, the words giving some meaning to this dream, we see an amazing universalism. It doesn't say some men, but it says all men. It doesn't say all white men, but it says all men, which includes black men. It doesn't say all Gentiles, but it says all men, which includes Jews. It doesn't say all Protestants, but it says all men, which includes Catholics. And very seldom, if ever, in the history of the world has a socio-political document expressed in such profound, eloquent and unequivocal language the dignity and the worth of human personality. For the American dream reminds us at every point that every man is heir of a legacy of dignity and worth. And yet we must face the shameful fact that ever since the founding fathers of our nation dreamed this dream, America has been something of a schizophrenic personality, tragically divided against itself. On the one hand, we have proudly professed the principles of democracy. And on the other hand, we have sadly practiced the very antithesis of those principles. Slavery and segregation have been strange paradoxes in the nation founded on the principle that all men are created equal. And yet more than ever before, we are challenged to realize this dream, for the shape of the world today does not afford us the luxury of an anemic democracy. And the price that America must pay for the continued depression of the Negro and other minority groups is the price of its own destruction. The hour is late, and the clock of destiny is ticking out, and we must act now before it is too late. Now, I must hasten to say that we must not seek to solve this problem merely to meet the communist challenge, as important as that is. We must not seek to solve this problem merely to appeal to Asian and African peoples. In the final analysis, racial discrimination must be uprooted from American society because it is morally wrong. Segregation must be ended because it stands against all of the noble precepts of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Segregation must be ended because it substitutes an I-it relationship for the I-thou relationship and relegates persons to the status of things. And so it must be done not merely because it is diplomatically expedient, but because it is morally compelling. Therefore, all people of goodwill, North and South, will work with grim and bold determination to bring an end to all of the evils that we find in our society. And I think this is the significance of the movement taking place in the South today. This is the great significance of the student movement that you've read so much about. For as these students sit down at lunch counters, they are in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and taking our whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And that is a need for people all over this nation to be creatively maladjusted until this problem is solved. This is the challenge of the hour. This is the dimension of breath calling us to be so concerned about America, so concerned about the world, so concerned about our brothers in need, that we will take a risk for that which is morally right, the risk of being unpopular, the risk of being criticized, the risk of being dismissed as a dangerous rabble-rouser and agitator, the risk of even being called a red because you believe in brotherhood. This is a risk, because one comes to the point of knowing that discrimination on the basis of race or religion is wrong, and somebody must stand up. This is the dimension of breath in the area of race relations. Now, this text also has a great deal of meaning in the international situation. It means that we must be concerned about other nations, for no nation can live alone in the world today. Nations are interdependent. Some few months ago, it was my good fortune to journey to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to talk with the great leaders of India and to meet the people of that country in the villages and in the cities. And these experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But I say to you this morning that as I traveled through India, there were those depressing moments. For how can one avoid being depressed when he sees millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes millions of people sleeping on the sidewalks at night? No beds to sleep in, no houses to go in. How can one avoid being concerned when he discovers that out of India's population of 400 million people, more than 350 million make an annual income of less than $70 a year, and most of these people have never seen a doctor or a dentist? And as I noticed these conditions, something within me cried out, can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? An answer came, oh no, because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking about the fact that in our country we spend more than $1 million a day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge, in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of people in Asia and Africa and South America who go to bed hungry at night. And maybe we spent far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. All I'm saying is simply this. All life is interrelated. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly, it affects all indirectly. John Donne placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And the recognition of this is a mastery of the dimension of breath. And that is a final dimension. Many people never get beyond these first two dimensions, and so they seek to live life without a sky. But if life is to be complete, I would suggest that the individual must rise up beyond his self-interest, even beyond humanity, and discover the eternal God whose purpose changes not. Now I know that some people have neglected this third dimension for honest intellectual reasons. They have looked out and noticed the problem of evil. They've looked out and noticed that something that the poet Keats calls the giant agony of the world. And so they begin to ask if that is a good God, a loving God who is at the same time all-powerful, why does he allow evil of this nature to exist in the universe? Others have noticed the church, an organized religion. They've noticed that the church itself is often stagnant and lax. They've noticed the church itself is often a taillight instead of the headlight. They've noticed that people in the church all too often have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. And from this they have concluded that the church has no relevance for the social issues of our day. And so because of their disgust with organized religion, they have turned away from the third dimension of life. And then others find it difficult to square their intellectual worldviews with the sometimes unscientific and primitive dogmas of religion. But I suspect that most of the people who have neglected this third dimension have done it not for honest intellectual reasons, but because they have become so unconsciously involved in the things of life. And so they've ended up living on the plane of secularism and materialism unconsciously. But in spite of our theoretical denials, we continue to have spiritual experiences that cannot be explained in materialistic terms. In spite of our doubts, we continue to feel another order impinging upon us. In spite of our inordinate worship of things, ever and again something comes to remind us that the lasting and eternal things of reality are never seen. And so we go out at night and look up at the beautiful stars as they bedeck the heavens like swinging lanterns of eternity, and for the moment we feel that we see all. Then something comes to remind us that we can never see the law of gravitation that holds them there. We come into this beautiful chapel. We walk around this campus with all of its beautiful buildings and significant architecture, and for the moment we think we see all, but then something comes to remind us that we can never see the mind of the architect who drew the blueprint. We can never see the love and the faith and the hope of the individuals who made these buildings possible. Well, you look here this morning, and I'm sure you're saying, I see Martin Luther King, and I guess I'm saying, I see you. But I say to you, you only see my body. You only see the external manifestation of me. You can never see my mind. You can never see my personality. You can never see the me that makes me me. Everything that we see is a shadow cast by that which we do not see. And so maybe Plato was right. The visible is a shadow cast by the invisible. And so even though we can't see God, it is still possible that God is in this universe. And so all of our new developments can banish God neither from the microcosmic compass of the atom, nor from the vast, unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. For living in a universe in which we are forced to measure stellar distance in light years, confronted with the illimitable expanse of the solar system, in which stars are 500 million million miles from the Earth, in which the ages of planets are reckoned in terms of billions of years, and heavenly bodies travel at incredible speed, modern man is forced to cry out with the psalmist of old, "When I behold the heavens, the work of thy hands, the moon and the stars, and all that thou hast created, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou remembereth him?" And so may it not be that St. Augustine was right. We were made for God, and we will be restless until we find rest in him. And so this dimension gives us a bit of faith in the future. It gives us a sense of cosmic companionship as we struggle to grapple with the problems of life and the problems of the universe. At times, people have said that the struggle taking place in the South and the individuals involved in the movement have developed a sort of spiritual movement. And I don't think they are talking about religion in the negative sense or a meaningless religion, but I think it is a spiritual movement in the sense that the participants, by and large, have faith in the future. And the participants somehow feel that in the struggle for that which is right, in the struggle for justice, that is cosmic companionship. Those students have developed a marvelous little song. It goes something like this: "We shall overcome, we shall overcome. Deep in my heart I do believe we shall overcome." And so in a real sense, when one pursues the dimension of height, he can sing, "We shall overcome." Before the victory for brotherhood is won, some may have to get scarred up, but we shall overcome. Before the victory for justice is won, some may be thrown in jail, but still we shall overcome. Before the victory for brotherhood is won, some will have to be misunderstood, but we shall overcome. Why? Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And that is something in this universe which justifies Carlyle in saying, "No lie can live forever." That is something in this universe which justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying, "Truth crest earth will rise again." That is something in this universe that justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, "Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own." And so with this faith in the future, we will be able to adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. I say to you in conclusion, love yourself, if by that you mean rational and healthy self-interest. You are commanded to do that. That is the length of life. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. You are commanded to do that. That is the breath of life. But never forget that that is the first and even greater commandment. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. That is the height of life. And with this, when this is developed, the individual lives a complete life. Thank God for John, who centuries ago had vision of the new Jerusalem. And grant that those of us who live life today will decide to move toward that city of complete life, in which the length and the breadth and the height are equal. And when we decide this collectively, figuratively speaking, the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy.
This is Greta Anderson, KHOI reporter, We've just listened to Martin Luther King's sermon, The Dimensions of a Complete Life. With me here today are two professors of speech from Iowa State University, Dr. Amy Slagle and Dr. Ben Crosby. Ben has published on Dr. King's works, and Amy will be teaching King in her History of American Public Address this semester. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, I'm curious to know what your first reactions were to hearing this speech as opposed to reading the text. How did Dr. King sound to your ears?
The thing that strikes me about not only this recording, but about his style of speaking when he's delivering a sermon, a traditional kind of in-the-church sermon, is how restrained he is compared to his more famous speeches when he's out in public and he's speaking to a much larger, more public audience. So the restraint of his voice, the very measured pace of his voice, strikes me as something not a lot of people identify with him. And it's something that ought to be better known because he has a beautiful, restrained voice when he's talking this way. He has the same sort of musicality. Yeah. It's just slower, but it's certainly distinctively Martin Luther King.
And then we also hear some passages that are either sound exactly like we hear them in other speeches, or they sound strikingly different.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real delight to have the chance to listen to this text. I'm so glad it was captured, because it does broaden our sense of his skills as a speaker and how he really engaged with audiences.
Would you say it's more intimate because it's a sermon dealing with spiritual things?
Yes. Unlike some of, again, the more public speeches, which have to do with your collective and social movement, the call to action is a little more about the individual call. So it has that spiritual sense of your awakening, your responsibility, making sure your life is complete.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, too, attending to your own spirituality.
That's a great point, yeah. That's right. This is a very traditional sermon in some respects. He starts out with a text, and a traditional Protestant sermon, historically at least, includes a lot of lecture. This is part of the restrained nature of this discourse. He's teaching principles here, and he's not just trying to move people to some sort of protest, as he does in other more famous speeches, but he's really trying to teach principles. And he does so brilliantly, and that's one of the things that a lot of people will be, I don't know, a little bit surprised at, because they associate him with these other speeches, these kind of high-flown, grand rhetorical speeches. When the style of this speech is restrained, it's based on teaching principles. The paragraphs are long and developed. There are links. He uses the principles as a premise to some sort of action. So everything is interconnected with this speech. It's structured. It flows.
It's a good five-paragraph essay.
That's right.
Just expand it out into
three main points.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, he previews things. He has transitions. He reviews. You know, it's a very disciplined discourse, and that's one of the things I really like about it. This is a distinctive in the way that it teaches.
How does this speech fit into his larger body of work?
I think probably everybody listening to the text heard that line about jangling discord in the Symphony of Brotherhood. And that is almost word for word a preview of the speech he's going to give just about a year and a half later on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and the famous I Have a Dream speech and that March on Washington.
Right.
And you know, he goes back to some similar text, biblical story. So he's often moved by the Good Samaritan tale. And again, in this other really famous speech, the Mountaintop Address, he tells the story of the Good Samaritan, and there we know the text because it seems to predict his death at the end. He talks about seeing the promised land, and I may not get there with you, but I've seen it. And it's very moving at the end, but the speech in its real focus is about the strike of the sanitation workers, and he takes the story of the Good Samaritan very seriously there, so that the same question he asks in this text we just heard, what does it mean to me if I help this person or not, isn't what matters. It's what happens to this person.
If I don't.
And that's the motivational appeal that he uses consistently.
From the beginning of his sermonizing career to the very end, he was on message. And he was not afraid to use what worked. And this is one of the things people will realize as they read or listen to King's speeches. He recycles phrases. He recycles principles and philosophies and elements. He's not afraid to use what works over and over again. And, of course, that's one of the chief rules of good messaging. You just keep repeating it, even if you're tired of it. Eventually, other people will get the message. And he understood that principle very well.
Were there any parts of this sermon that surprised you that you hadn't heard before in your study of King?
I was struck by his turn to the international issues. He kind of early in the speech so reflects on the trip to Jerusalem, and you have that lovely setting for the Good Samaritan story where you have the dangerous curve of the Jericho Road really laid out for listeners so that you can kind of recreate the moment of that. And that helps him tell that story really with new insights that are a lot of fun, and you could hear the pleasure even of the crowd.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite moments in the speech.
But I caught my breath with the line, and then again here today, I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of people in Asia and Africa. And it was just kind of unexpected, the world vision there, and we don't necessarily remember King for that interconnectedness. We often think of Malcolm X and his international vision, but King is also really concerned about the world community and has that outreach focus too, and that kind of responsibility of wealthier nations to step up. The other surprise was that phrase, creatively maladjusted, a need for the people of this nation to be creatively maladjusted until this problem is solved. And I know that phrase. He gave a speech at the American Psychological Association. So he went to the APA at one point to talk to social scientists about their responsibility in helping solve issues of poverty and economic distress in the nation, and what, you know, trying to pull the energy of intellectuals into problem solving in a very concrete way for the nation. And he has a whole section in that about the creative maladjustment, which he's kind of been playing on. I mean, he's in front of the psychologists who determine what is normal behavior and not normal, and says we need some discomfort and shouldn't adjust to religious bigotry. We shouldn't adjust to, we should be maladjusted to things that are wrong in our culture, and that's a great call. So I was really surprised to hear that vocabulary announced.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that vocabulary before either, but the principle is throughout his writings, and that is we cannot be satisfied with what's normal, because what's normal is dangerous. What's normal isn't solving any problem. What's normal is to wait for things to improve themselves. What we need to do is confront what's normal.
Yeah, or comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
That's right.
When he talks about what is the ideal, it's how can society be structured such that everyone might lead a creative life. Creative and create, he uses that word a lot. His gesture to non-believers was quite interesting in a sermon to refer to those who might not have the same views. What did you think of that?
I think it's consistent with what King himself has set up here. He's talking about breadth, and breadth is a way of thinking about tolerance. It's a way of thinking about inclusion. He doesn't want people just to live their lives according to the length, which is caring about yourself, but the breadth, which means including others. And he uses that word other very strategically in this sermon. So I think the idea of including a non-believer is very consistent with the philosophy he's promoting in this sermon and throughout his career.
But it is interesting how he goes directly then to what he wants to consider a shared human experience, confronting nature in a sense of awe when he talks about stepping out, looking at the stars, and he speaks of that quite poetically. That does create an opportunity for an ecumenical kind of perspective that is not necessarily part of a lot of sermons, you know, who are advocating a particular religious tradition. So there is that breadth is really exemplified in a very deep way about a shared spirituality that might be based on a sense of awe rather than a personal relationship.
And that is very consistent with a lot of the theological work that was being done in the 60s and a little bit before the 60s. That's very consistent with a lot of the stuff King himself was reading and a few of the names he referenced in this speech. So it's not surprising to hear that at the end of the speech. There's a argument for God through this notion of universality and awe.
Mm-hmm. Well, then he goes on. The stars and how far away they are and how fast the heavenly bodies are really moving. Mm-hmm. All of this new scientific information that he brings in, I thought that was kind of interesting. But what did you think about
You think you see Martin Luther King, but you might not see what makes me me. What did you think of that moment in the speech?
My initial just gut reaction is that I really, really liked it. You know, the argument that's behind that moment is this claim that there's more to life than what we see. There's more to everything than what we see. There's more to the building, the chapel that they're in. Mm-hmm. And there's more to the world than what we see. And there's even more to me than what you see. So this is a speech about dimensions. This is the third dimension where he's talking about reaching towards God. And reaching towards God is an act of faith, and we can't always see what we're reaching for, but it's there. It doesn't mean it's not there.
Amy, what did you think of that moment?
One does wonder, and of course, you know, you think of the autobiography of King and the discussions about who he really is and mm-hmm, was, and you look at the complexities of his personal life, and so it invites all sorts of things for you as a listener. So I had some of the interference of those kinds of issues of the real me that I was glad to get back into the solar system, meditation,
terrain.
And recognize that the move in the speech, in terms of the speech, is moving us toward faith in things unseen.
Right.
And a perspective of breadth that's going to lead us up to the most marvelous line of the speech, right? That the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there we're coming in to the conclusion of the speech, and it's a recognition that we're all more than we appear that creates a sense of our own possibilities. I mean, and in that sense, it is still really a motivational speech.
Oh, certainly.
In a very deep way.
He says that in the context of the work that all of the members of the movement in the South are doing. I love that part of the speech myself.
Giving the kudos to the students. And the students step into such an amazing role in the drives for voter registration, the sit-ins, the arrests. I mean, what age group is it that suffers most from a lot of that? And then in this speech to say, the students have developed a marvelous song, and it goes like this, and we shall overcome. And it's like, because we're here many years later, decades later, and that's like a popular song. We all know what it harkens to, but to be able to hear him in this time when it was new, it was just invented, and to do a kind of riff on We Shall Overcome, it was a wonderful, wonderful moment in the speech.
And this is also a moment in the speech where we can highlight the undeniable fact that King does not distinguish between political concerns and religious imperatives. He sees political and social problems as fundamentally religious problems. And so whenever he talks about issues of poverty or war, for example, or racism, it's always within the context of this spiritual framework that is the premise of everything he does, which complicates things. It complicates debates. You know, when we start talking about separating church and state, it's convenient to do that sometimes, and then it's convenient not to do that sometimes because we don't want to lose this tradition of activism that is based in a real faith. So he makes things a little complicated in that way, but he's unapologetic about it. He's going to use his faith to spur social change.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the speech?
The thing that I love is his use of time. He loves talking about time. There are so many references to time, running out of time or the quality of time, moment, opportunity. Words like this are scattered throughout this sermon. And I think this is one of the most important themes if you're going to study King's speech, King's rhetoric. He does not believe in chronological time, or at least he doesn't want to believe it. He wants to reject it. He doesn't like this idea of that time just sort of marches forward and we're just sort of controlled by it. He wants to confront time. He wants to interrupt it and to create moments of divine intervention, create moments where God can come into the world and change the trajectory of time. And so if you look closely at a speech by Martin Luther King, including this one, you'll see the way he fights time.
So in this text, he hits that moment of time so strongly when he says, "The hour is late and the clock of destiny is ticking out, and we must act now before it is too late." In the I Have a Dream, it's now is the time.
Now is the fierce urgency of now.
Yeah.
In other speeches, he says we need to help time, as if we can control it. If we're just waiting for civil rights, That's a dangerous proposition. We're just waiting for time, which is what a lot of very reasonable folks in the 1960s were saying. Hold on. It's coming. Be patient. And King, of course, said no. You know, I mean, in his letter from Birmingham jail, he got really angry at moderates who were probably very reasonable people. He got angry at them and he said, no, we can't wait on time. We have to confront time. But anyway, I think it's all about this theme of fulfillment. The quality of our life is fulfilled or measured by its influence, not by its duration.
And he comes right back to that at the very last speech. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
I don't care about the duration of life.
That's right. That's exactly right. He lived this principle. I may not get there with you. I may not get to the mountaintop with you, but that's okay.
Because I've been there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I may not get to the promised land, but I've been to the mountaintop. Yeah. The quality of my life is such that the duration doesn't matter.
Longevity has its place.
Longevity has its place. That's mm-hmm. right.
When he spoke the words about, you don't see what makes me me, it's interesting to me that you, all of those FBI investigations clouded your mind, because at that moment I just trembled in my shoes. Literally, I thought, who is he? How close to the source he is.
The spark of the divine, really, that hits you as a moment. Which I'm sure it did for the people in the...
This is an unlikely comparison, but it comes to mind now that we're talking about it. In a speech right before his death, Joseph Smith said something similar.
He said, really?
Yeah, he did. He did. He said, you don't know me. No man knows me. No man knows my history. And if I didn't live it, I wouldn't believe it myself. And it was shortly thereafter that he was killed. And I wonder if there's a theme here. If there's some sort of spark or ego or something that brings a religious leader to this moment where he has to remind people, you think you know me, but you don't. I don't want to speculate, but it's an interesting moment.
It's hard to understand.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. What does that mean? What are you trying to tell us?
Well, thank you so much for coming down. It's so fun to talk about this stuff. It's such a rich speech. I really appreciate your thoughts and your work on this.
Our pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to a Martin Luther King Day special. This hour we featured a sermon entitled Dimensions of a Complete Life, given by the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1962 at Yale University Chapel. The audio was captured by Pacifica Radio and preserved by Pacifica Radio Archive. We spoke with two professors from Iowa State University's Department of English, Dr. Amy Slagle and Dr. Ben Crosby. Our theme music was We Shall Overcome, performed by the O'Neill Brothers. Of Iowa theme song was The Fisherman by Leo Kottke from his album 6 and 12 String Guitar. Richard Morrison was the engineer of the show. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. I've enjoyed production assistance from Ursula Rudenberg, who helped edit the show, as well as general help from Deborah Bunka, Cynthia McClure, Sarah Hegland, Susan Franzen, and my husband, Mark Harris. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.